Welcome back to The Daily Drum on WHUR and Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Inside segment. I'm Harold Fisher. She was only the second woman appointed to the highest court in the land, but Supreme Court Associate Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg was arguably the most well-known and influential. Tonight, we take a look at the impact she had on the Supreme Court, the nation, and the fight to fill her seat. Joining me to talk about this are D.C.'s Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton and Howard University political science professor Dr. Michael Fauntroy. Lines are open if you have a comment about Ginsburg, her legacy, and the fight to fill her seat. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Tweet me at hfisher, W-H-U-R, or find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Dr. Fauntroy and Congressman Norton, thank you so much for joining us.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Congresswoman, are you there?
Thank you.
Yeah, I want to first, before we get into the justice's legacy, I want to ask you about something that we've been hearing over the past 24 hours or so, particularly on the Sunday news talk shows, about the Democrats wanting to expand the court to 10 or even 11 seats. Can you kind of give me a bit of a breakdown on what that is about for those who are not familiar with that?
Well, I really don't think that's worth your time, because Democrats not only don't want to expand the court, Justice Ginsburg herself said that she thought 9 was a good number, but they can't expand the court. It would take 2 houses to do so. So I think that's not worth a lot of time.
Well, I appreciate that. But with that said, for those who have questioned that, what is that about? If you could just give me kind of a brief synopsis of where that's even coming from.
Well, I frankly don't know where it's coming from. I haven't heard any member of Congress say that.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't tell you where it's coming from. It may be coming from some tweets of somebody.
Mm-hmm. Very well.
So I can add a little bit to that.
Okay.
It appears to be coming from the sort of activist class who are in the process of floating ideas about what the retaliation could look like in the event that Majority Leader McConnell and the president sort of rush somebody through immediately. And this, of course, assumes that Vice President Biden will win the presidential election, that the Democrats will take the Senate. But as Congresswoman Norton appropriately pointed out, there are so many ifs involved in all of this and a variety of downstream byproducts that it's really not a serious, viable option. And the consequence doesn't require a lot of...
Yeah, so one of the parts of that option, I certainly agree, is that D.C. statehood would... Somehow, D.C. statehood will give you 2 senators, and they've been thrown into that. Well, we got D.C. statehood through the House, but it's going to take more than that to get it through the Senate.
Yes, indeed. So I would agree with that.
Option, we both agree.
Talk to me, Congresswoman, about what Ginsburg has meant, not only to the court, but to this nation from your perspective.
Well, I have a perspective on her as a person I knew, as a friend,
mm-hmm.
and as a justice. I knew Justice Ginsburg and introduced her at her confirmation hearing. I, of course, had followed her work. She was a D.C. resident, and I had known her for many, many years. But I think one has to look at her work before she went on the court as much as her work on the court. On the court, she was always part of a 5-4 minority. Off the court, when I was an assistant legal director of the American Civil Liberties Union, I worked with her when she was not paid staff but ran the ACLU Women's Rights Project. That work, before she went on the court, resulted in 6 cases going before the court. She argued them all and won 5 of them. They were women's rights cases. That set of cases established women's equality in our country, including one of her cases that for the first time said that the 14th Amendment applied to women. So think about that. The 14th Amendment applied to blacks before it applied to women. That work, that that early work, was not repeated on the court when she was in the minority. So if anyone were to ask me, I would say her greatest contribution was even before she went on the court, mm-hmm. even though she is lionized as the great dissenter on the court today.
Mm-hmm. The same question for you, Dr. Fauntroy, as it relates to the iconic status that she achieved, particularly lately. She she literally became not a rock star, but a hip-hop star, you know, and which, you know, we've seen over the past several days her comments about that, in that she was so incredulous about her popularity.
Yeah. So I want to do that, but I also want to mention, you know, this Congresswoman Norton mentioned the Equal Protection Clause and applying it to women. You know, just think about how much the country has changed, because who wouldn't think that it would apply to women, right? But in 2020, but at the time she was arguing those cases, for some people that was an open question. So she really did help turn the wheel. And in terms of her sort of cultural resonance, I have to tell you, I can't tell you how many times I saw women on campus at Howard University in notorious RBG T-shirts or sweatshirts. And it just spoke to the way in which she, unlike so many other people, was able to break through, and whose relevance became relevant to younger people in ways that we'd never previously seen. I don't quite know how it happened. I think some people have been so impressed by, you know, her strength and in the face of physical frailty, right? And her toughness in terms of fighting against the many maladies that she's had to endure, that she endured over the years. But I think that there is a generation of young people in America, and it's in pockets. I don't want to suggest to you that it's all over the country, but there is a generation of young people all over the country who know what she did. And to me, that legacy will continue and speak for years to come.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We are talking about the legacy of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, as well as the fight already underway to fill the seat just left by her passing this past Friday. Let me go to Reggie real quick from Richmond. Reggie, thanks for calling. Quickly, what's on your mind?
Yes, good evening. It seems to me that the Republicans' talking points and some of their main things is to go after the Supreme Court. I really wish the Democrats had got on the horse and fought for it and put people like Roger Gregory in there, Judge Roger Gregory. I hope the Democrats stand up and start to put more emphasis on taking the Supreme Court.
Okay. Thank you so much. I appreciate that. Real quick, Dr. Fauntroy, your thoughts about what Reggie was just sharing with us?
Well, I think Democrats have placed a great emphasis on it. And by the way, had things turned out in 2016 the way they were projected to, we wouldn't be in this position right now, quite frankly. But it has certainly raised the Supreme Court to an equal level, as far as I can tell, with the president's response to coronavirus as the primary issues that are going to be driving the remainder of this campaign. And that's a double-edged sword, because a campaign focused on the Supreme Court is a lot more winnable for Republicans than one that is focused on the coronavirus response, which I think, you know, even the president's most staunch supporters would argue has not been good at all, and quite frankly has been incompetent.
Mm-hmm. Congresswoman Norton, you, I don't think, is overstating this point about yourself, that you are a pioneer in the position that you currently hold. And you and Ruth Bader Ginsburg have kind of come of age politically around the same time. What does her passing mean when you just kind of look back over the past, 24, 27 years as a justice when she was, you know, on the high court, and the work that you've done, you know, as a constitutional scholar and elected official?
Well, as a person who argued, I myself argued before the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a sense of its majesty and of the difficulty of convincing justices. I happen to have won that case. But I don't gainsay for a moment what it takes to do what she did when she was simply arguing before the court. I think of her, though, and I must say that for all the strength of her dissents, the brilliance of her mind, this was a soft-spoken dwarf of a woman, very small, in meetings when I was at the ACLU with her. She does not speak a lot. She spoke up when she had something to say. That's why Dr. Pomeroy's notion about her becoming such an icon is so counterintuitive. Yes, she has, but she didn't do anything to make it happen.
Yes, indeed, and I think it is certainly, you know, a privilege, particularly from, you know, your perspective, like-minded, to be able to have a front seat to what she, you know, what she had accomplished. I do want to talk a little bit about where we are right now. I have never seen anything like this, and even with the limited institutional knowledge that I have, just hours after her passing was announced, that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell issued a statement, essentially said, "We are moving on and moving forward." Is there anything that the Democrats can do constitutionally, legally, as they continue to push back on the speed with which the Trump administration is trying to push the new nominee? Or is this the exact reverse of Merrick Garland, essentially, where we have the power, we're going to get it done?
Well, I tell you, I don't see how they can get it done. We've got, what is it, 3 weeks?
About 4 weeks, yeah.
Yeah.
About that, yeah.
The lowest I've been able to find was, interestingly, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who did it in 50 days. But if you look at the process, Gorsuch, for example, to take a recent one, took 66 days. I choose him because he didn't take much time. Well, that's, you know, that's more than 2 months. When you consider what you have to do in order to just get through the process, I don't see how they can get through this process in that amount of time. You have got to visit with members of the Senate. You have got to have a hearing. You've got to have a vote. The time between a hearing and a vote and the number of days is prescribed by law. I really don't see it. I think time will run out. Especially am I heartened by the fact that two senators have already said that they don't think the vote should be taken before the election. The Senate is likely, if we go by the polls today, to fall to Democrats, not to mention the presidency, because he's in even greater trouble. If the Senate falls to Democrats, with more Republican Democrats at the moment being in danger than Democrats, you could lose senators who I don't think could vote or should vote in a lame duck session if they've already been defeated. So you see how complicated this gets. and why the best practice would be not to embroil yourself in this, but to wait until after the election.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We are talking about Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, her legacy, her impact on the court, the nation, and on the fight to fill her seat. If you have a comment, if you have a question, we'd love to hear from you tonight. Again, 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Congresswoman Norton, if you have a chance to stay with us just a little bit beyond 7:30, because I do have a constitutional question, and you're the person I want to have answer that, I would appreciate it if you were able to do so. I think it's really an important question, simply because stranger things have happened since 2016, and I think it's good for people to get a little constitutional 101 from Eleanor Holmes Norton, if you are available. I'd appreciate it.
Just a few minutes.
I promise I'll pass the pop quiz afterwards. I promise you that I most certainly will. But it will. But it certainly is, you know, an important question. And you know, we want to remind people that, of course, we will continue to follow the changes that seem to be happening literally moment by moment, including the fact that President Trump did say that he could have his nominee announced as early as Friday. So please, everyone, stay with us. D calling from Virginia. We're going to be talking to you in just a bit. Don't hang up. We're also going to be hearing from the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law after 7:30. But please, all of our listeners, stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. The original Quiet Storm with John Mons is next. If you want to hear this entire conversation, you can hear it on podcast after 9 o'clock. I will be posting that on WHUR.com as I do every night. So please stay with us. This conversation continues. Lines are still open at 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We'll be back in just a few seconds. Welcome back to the Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We're looking at the impact Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg had on the Supreme Court, the nation, and now the fight to fill her seat. We are continuing our conversation with D.C. Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton, as well as Dr. Walter Michael Fauntroy. Hey, thinking about your father. Michael Fauntroy, political science professor at Howard University. Lines are still open at 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. Congresswoman, the question that I had, you said that the Constitution requires a time between a hearing and a vote, but you also said that a nominee must meet with senators. Is that also constitutional? And this is why I ask, because must a nominee meet with senators, particularly if the Republicans hold the power, if they may be willing to rubber stamp a nominee, could they expedite this process?
Well, first, let me say the time after a hearing and a vote is not a matter of the Constitution. It's a matter of the Senate rules.
Okay.
But your question is,
can they fast track it?
Your question is, could they not meet with senators? Was that your question?
Yes, ma'am. No,
they can't do that. But the Democrats, for example, if the Republicans say we don't want to meet with her, we want to, we waive that. She'd have to meet with Democratic senators as well. They cannot deprive anybody who has the right to vote in the Senate of the right to meet with the person they're voting on. So that wouldn't work either.
So with that said, are there other ways that the Republicans could fast-track the nomination?
I don't think that's why I think they are up a creek here. I don't think the processes I just laid out are unavoidable, including meeting with members of the Senate.
I see. Well, we will continue to watch that, and I appreciate you sparing us a few extra minutes after 7:30. I know you are a very busy person, and even as this battle continues, you are going to get even busier, Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton. Thank you so much for sharing with us.
Thank you. Good to talk with you.
Yes, ma'am. I appreciate your time. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. D, calling from Virginia. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
It's just so hypocritical of the Republicans to do what they're doing. In 2016, Lindsey Ramsey said the same thing that McConnell said. And how we let them get away with this, I just don't understand.
Well, there it is right there, Dr. Fauntroy.
Can I just say one thing?
Yeah, go ahead.
I just hope that all my brothers and sisters, white, Latino, black, that we all go out and vote and stop all of this chaos. It's incredible.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Dr. Fauntroy, your thoughts?
Yeah, I was just going to add, you know, that comment really does speak to a lot of the frustration that so many people feel about this. Everybody, you know, people have disagreements about what's necessarily appropriate in terms of legislating, but everybody understands hypocrisy. Everybody understands what's good for the goose is good for the gander. And this is what we're at the early stages of seeing the exercise of just raw naked political power, which speaks to the lesson in all of this for everybody, particularly those who are bothered by the way this looks like it's about to go down, like the caller, and like me for that matter. And that is simply this. You can't do anything without the votes, which is why the Democrats are having to operate from a position of defense this go-round, because they don't have a majority. And while there are some things that they could do to delay in terms of the amount of time before hearings can be scheduled and make motions to do certain things to slow the process, if the Republicans stand strong and don't lose at least four members who want to go, like Senator Collins from Maine and Senator Murkowski from Alaska, who are saying, no, we can't do anything before the election, then the truth of the matter is the Republicans will have the votes and they can do whatever they want, even though it is rank hypocrisy and reversing previously stated positions from 2016. There's so much videotape out there, Harold, of Lindsey Graham and Mitch McConnell and all of these other folks on the Republican side saying in 2016, no, we're 11 months away from a presidential election. We can't have this nomination vote right now. And here we are now, 6 weeks away from the election, and they want to try to ram it through. People understand that. But it's one thing to understand it. It's another thing to then act on it at the ballot box.
We're now joined by Aaron Martin, Policy Counsel for the Public Policy Project at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. Aaron, thanks for joining the conversation. Aaron, can you hear me?
Thank you so much for joining the conversation.
I want to bring you in on the political salvos that we've heard, you know, today, from both the Democrats as well as the Republicans, as Dr. Fauntroy just said, we understand the hypocrisy and the fact that even if they hear the sound bites that this is what you said in 2016 and this is what you're saying now in 2020, but the reality is, Aaron, that elections have consequences, and this is as a result of the election of Donald Trump, and there are a lot of people today, particularly those who are on the left, who are saying, "I told you so," And that's kind of where we are. Talk to me about the fact that elections do have consequences.
Yes, I think we know elections have consequences, but I think we're in a very unique situation right now with the vacancy arising less than 45 days before the election. And as voters have already started heading to the polls and submitting their absentee ballots and engaging in early voting, and never in our country's history have we ever had a Supreme Court nomination proceed this close to an election, especially after one is already underway. You'd have to go back to President Lincoln in 1864 during the Civil War when we were last faced with this sort of situation. And even then, President Lincoln waited a month after he won re-election before he put forth a nominee.
And, you know, and I think, you know, that's the thing that really fascinates me, because, you know, prior to yesterday, I did not know that. And I was hearing, a lot of that. And even with the muscular lines that we are now seeing, for example, in Northern Virginia, people coming out, you know, to vote. The reality is that even if the Republicans cannot get this done before Election Day, isn't it quite possible that they could confirm a nominee in a lame duck session?
It is certainly possible, but I think it would be unfathomable for them to proceed in that way. I think it would just be a heightened level of hypocrisy, unlike anything we've seen beforehand. I think there would be ramifications for senators afterwards.
Dr.
Carol, can I jump in?
Yeah, please. Go ahead.
Thank you. So I want to underline what you said, because I think that's very important. So there's one election that is a special election in November. Right now, there's a Senator Martha McSally is trailing Mark Kelly, who's a retired astronaut, by something like 10 points. And she's very likely to flip the seat from Republican to Democrat. Here's why that's important. That seat he could be seated almost immediately after the election, because it's a special election and not a regular term election, all right? Now, there's some nuance in Arizona law, but the point is he would be in the seat before the end of this calendar year. And if there were a vote in December during a lame duck, for example, it's quite possible that there would be one fewer Republican to vote for a Trump nominee. At that point, you only then need two others. And it's given the optics and the pressure that would be building, particularly looking toward 2022 for those senators who are running for reelection. It is possible that a Republican nominee could be defeated during a lame duck. Not entirely likely, but certainly possible.
But Dr. Fauntroy, to the point that I was trying to share with Congresswoman Norton, as much as the Democrats may try to delay, the Republicans may try to fast track. And constitutional rules notwithstanding, we have seen rules change.
So Harold, they could rush this through if they wanted to. If the president, it looks like the president's prepared to name someone this weekend following Justice Ginsburg's funeral service. And at that point, Republicans are going to be putting a whole lot of pressure to try to get this done. Trump wants it done before the election. I don't think that's out of the realm of possibility. I don't think it's necessarily likely, but it certainly could be done. And Senate Majority Leader McConnell has shown repeatedly that he's willing to do whatever it takes to get what he wants. And I don't think anybody should be surprised if they don't try to rush it through. Yes, you have to have some meetings, although the shape and form of those can take many different, can happen in a variety of different ways. And hearings could be shaped the way the majority wants the hearings to be shaped. They could theoretically have one day of hearings, not really talk about a whole lot, and then have a vote. So there are a number of different ways this could go.
You know, Aaron, when talking about the unlikely process that they could move through this exponentially, and the so-called hypocrisy of the Republicans right now,
If you take the example of Merrick Garland back when in 2016, hypocrisy seems to be more like the order of the day instead of, you know, instead of having people clutch their pearls and say, oh, my goodness, this is a different kind of presidency. This is a different kind of Senate. And so, you know, do you think that people really care about the hypocrisy, or people just really want what they want when you're talking about conservatives and having a conservative block on the court? Your thoughts about that?
I definitely think that there's a stronger sense of what's at stake right now than it feels like there was in 2016. I think a lot of more progressive and Democrat-leaning voters definitely weren't thinking about the potential impact that the court could have on the 2016 election, even though they may have been incensed about the hypocrisy with the Merrick Garland. But I think right now, you know, the Supreme Court is hearing a case on the Affordable Care Act a week after the election. And I think it's more front and center. I think we've had a summer filled with protests against racial violence. And I think that voting rights is front and center for a lot of voters. And I think people will be more galvanized to turn out and vote in November if they do try to jam this through.
Hmm. But with that said, is it almost, you know, for those who are supporting the Affordable Care Act and those who want to see Roe v. Wade remain the law of the land, it almost seems to me as if it's too little too late.
I don't think so necessarily. I think, you know, we are a nonpartisan organization, but I do think there is a lot of power in the people and turning out to vote and in electing representatives who represent their ideals and what they'd like to see enacted into law. So I think you're going to see, we're hoping for large voter turnout, and that will actually see people who are elected who represent the will of the voters.
I need to take a break, and also we need to say goodbye to Dr. Michael Fauntroy. Thank you so much, Dr. Fauntroy, for spending some time with us in this really important conversation. Of course, we will stay in touch because I'm sure we will need to talk to you again as things continue to move forward. So, Dr. Fauntroy, thank you so much. I appreciate
it's
your time.
It's always a pleasure. Always a pleasure. I'm always here for you. Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to take a break. When we come back, more of this discussion and what this may mean for the highest court in the land. Lines are still open. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM, Channel 141. We are looking at the impact Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg had on the Supreme Court, the nation, and now the fight to fill her seat. Our conversation continues with Aaron Martin, Policy Counsel for the Public Policy Project at the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law. So, Aaron, as you spoke about before the break, that one of the first hearings that we will hear after election on the High Court is about Obamacare. What are the issues in play there?
That case is a challenge from several states that were brought basically challenging the legality of the Affordable Care Act. And it basically, the lower courts have ruled to strike it down. And we're basically looking at losing access to health care as it's provided under the Affordable Care Act if the Supreme Court were to uphold the lower court decision.
And then, of course, there's been a lot of discussion, as I mentioned before, about Roe v. Wade, the landmark case that provides, you know, access to abortion for, you know, women in the U.S. What do you believe that it is possible if a conservative is appointed to this court that will change? I mean, and what does, and you know, more broadly, what could a 6-3 conservative majority mean for things, for example, like civil rights, Are you concerned at all about the possibility that civil rights or voting rights could long term be curtailed?
I definitely think I'll start off with Roe v. Wade. I think in that instance, the jurisprudence following Roe v. Wade has been so intertwined within American life since the case was decided. It would be quite difficult to strike it down and overrule it outright. I think what we've kind of seen since that decision was handed down in the 70s is that there's just been a constant chipping away at access to reproductive health care and access to contraception. And I think that's what we'll gradually see in the coming years if there were a conservative majority on the Supreme Court. From the way that the cases are coming up, most of the voting rights, for example, with the Shelby County decision in 2013, what we saw was not an outright overturning of the Voting Rights Act. We saw a key provision of it struck down. So we're just going to, I think there's a potential for a lot of our civil rights to just kind of be chipped away at in the coming years if there is a stronger conservative majority on the bench.
And what about voting rights? Because certainly, your organization is strong proponent of that, and we've already seen over the years a chipping away of of voting rights and who can and how it's done. Do you see that is a battle that will dust up again after the appointment of a new justice, and what concerns might you have about that?
Yeah, I think you can even look at the most recent case in Florida where, voters went to the ballot and voted that people who are formerly incarcerated would be eligible to vote in the election. And we basically had afterwards the legislature in Florida pass the law saying that they had to pay all of their fines and fees and restitution before they'd be eligible to vote. And part of the issue was that one is the record keeping in terms of the amount of fines and fees that are actually owed and just the significant burden that places on low income people, especially people who are formerly incarcerated and may have trouble, gaining access to employment and gaining access to student loans to cover higher education so that they can have that pathway to a better life. So it effectively disenfranchised a lot of people. Even though the voters had, passed the law, a referendum, in order to allow those people to vote. And that resulted in a court challenge. And we recently saw the 11th Circuit decided week before last on September 10th, to reverse the lower court decision and hold that the legislature's law requiring the fines and fees to be paid would block that it actually would block a lot of the formerly incarcerated persons from being able to vote in the November election. And one of the judges who was on that case is one of the judges who's on President Trump's shortlist, Judge Barbara Lagoa. So I definitely think we're going to see issues like that come up. I think that law in Florida effectively acts as a poll tax on a lot of voters who are lower income and who may have incurred a fine or fee. And the civil or criminal legal system.
That term.
Things like that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that term poll tax, conjures up some really dark parts, of American history. And for a lot of people, a 6-3 conservative majority may seem to be back to the future, particularly for marginalized groups, African Americans, Latinx people who want to vote, in addition to the formerly incarcerated, as you just mentioned, who have served their term behind bars. And to that point, you mentioned, for example, Barbara Lagoa. For example, mm-hmm. she is on the president's short list, and then there is also the Amy Coney
Barrett.
Yeah, Barrett. Do you have any information that you can share about the the Cliff Notes resume of these two women and what they may mean going forward if either one of them were appointed to the court?
I think they are, both of them are described as very conservative. Judge Barrett is currently a Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals judge. She was appointed in 2017 along a tight party line vote on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and as well as her confirmation before the Senate. She, you know, she refused to say that Brown v. Board of Education was correctly decided during her confirmation hearing. She's definitely not, you know, those are the sorts of things we think of integration in Brown v. Board as a seminal decision that's not even up for debate. So it's kind of incredulous that you would have a nominee who would say that Brown v. Board wasn't correctly decided. I think with Barbara Lagoa, she was confirmed to the 11th Circuit in 2019. She definitely has a lot more judicial experience. She was a state court judge in Florida for many years before she was appointed last year to the federal court. She was involved in the voting rights case, as I mentioned before, and I think she's also been involved in a few employment matters as well. But I think they both, you know, we definitely think that judges, especially federal judges and especially judges who are appointed to the Supreme Court, need to be fair and neutral arbiters of the law. And we want to make sure that we're appointing people who have, who adhere to that and who believe in equal justice under the law and equal protection under the law, the way that Justice Ginsburg did and the way that Justice Marshall did. And I think what we see with Judge Barrett and Judge Lagoa is if either of them were to be selected, this would be one of the first times since Justice Marshall was appointed where we don't have a Supreme Court justice who has that sort of civil rights background on the court, because none of the other justices have that at the moment. And I think it's very important in terms of humanizing the role that the law has on the lives of everyday Americans. And I think that's what Justice Ginsburg definitely tried to make sure she always did, was advocate for the working Americans.
Well, I want to thank you so much for sharing your perspective on this really important issue. And as we said earlier, elections have consequences, and we will have to deal with those consequences as we move through this process. Aaron Martin with the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me. Have a good day.
Absolutely. Also, I want to thank Howard University Science Professor Dr. Michael Fauntroy, as well as D.C. Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton, for participating in this conversation. That is the Daily Drum for this Monday, September 21st. I'm Harold Fisher. Now, stay tuned to Unheard with our own Wes Hall.